Thousands of big white snowy owls from the Arctic are descending around Lake Erie.
Oh my God, that thing is beautiful. Jeez.
Some scientists wonder if they're a harbinger of climate change or just part of a natural cycle. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Today on the Allegheny Front, we begin Climate Chronicles, a year-long series about the impacts of climate change on our region, with a look at the biggest movement of snowy owls in 50 years.
Oh, those eyes.
Yeah.
Those eyes are beautiful.
Plus, a West Virginian who lived through the recent chemical spill and water crisis there judges a drinking water contest. This and more is coming your way on the Allegheny Front. Please stay tuned. With the primary election coming up, Democrats keep lining up to take a run at Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's seat. And fracking is on the minds of many candidates. The latest to enter the race is former Pennsylvania Auditor Jack Wagner. Last month, he became the seventh Democrat to throw his hat into the ring, with just a few weeks left to file nominating petitions. Wagner's working to distinguish himself in a field where candidates' policy positions differ little. He says he's in favor of fracking, but wants to see it done safely.
The top priority of the Commonwealth has to be to protect our environment, our land, our waterways. The big issue related to fracking is precisely that. It's protecting our waterways. We have 80,000 miles of rivers and streams in Pennsylvania. 5,000 of those 80,000 miles are polluted.
Wagner stops well short of saying he'll support a moratorium on new natural gas drilling permits. A moratorium proposal was supported by Lebanon County Commissioner Joellen Litz at a candidates' forum last month. Now, State Treasurer Rob McCord, former DEP Secretaries John Hanger and Katie McGinty, and York County businessman Tom Wolf all say they'd back an extension of the current moratorium on drilling in public lands. Congresswoman Allison Schwartz says she would support an expansion of the ban to cover the Delaware River Basin as well. Reporting for this story was provided by WESA. This is the Allegheny Front. In the world of wizardry, snowy owls carry covert messages between sorcerers. Is their appearance by the thousands in our region saying something to us about climate change? People have reported seeing thousands of the magnificent Arctic birds from Erie, Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C., all the way to Bermuda. Researchers say there are more owls this season than anyone has seen in 50 years. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant looks into the debate over why this is happening.
They started showing up last fall. Most years, birdwatchers on Presque Isle, north of Erie, spot one or maybe two snowy owls. John Lasco says last November, the first owl showed up. Then they spotted another.
Soon there were five, and then there were six, and then there was eight, and then there were up to 13 to 15 snowy owls all at one time on the park.
Laskos is an environmental educator at the Tom Ridge Environmental Center on Presque Isle. Snowy owls are adapted to live at the top of the world in the dark, cold Arctic winter. He says the unusually high numbers on Presque Isle have encouraged other winter visitors to the area, photographers, researchers.
The birders especially went crazy over this.
And it's not just on Presque Isle.
Oh my God, that thing is beautiful. Jeez.
Ron Cole was among the birders who stopped along a roadside south of Jamestown, New York, to look at this snoozing snowy, its fluffy white feathers dotted with black and its sharp yellow eyes.
Oh, those eyes.
Yeah.
Those eyes are beautiful.
Snowies are among the largest owls, weighing in at around 5 pounds, with a 4-foot-long wingspan. They're known by many because of Harry Potter's pet raptor, Hedwig. Scott Weidensall of Millersburg in eastern Pennsylvania has been studying them for many years and is excited by the numbers and attention they're getting this year.
It's madness, I tell you.
Weidensall is a naturalist who's led groundbreaking owl research at the Ned Smith Center for Nature and Art.
We're in the middle of what's known as an eruption, and that's spelled IRR rather than ER.
He says snowy owl eruptions occur every 3 to 5 years, but researchers didn't expect anything of this magnitude, the large numbers of owls so widespread across North America. Weidensahl and a few colleagues started something called Project Snowstorm last year to start tracking snowies. He says he's never been involved in a project that got pulled together so quickly.
The first week of December, we all kind of looked around at each other and said, oh my God, there's snowy owls everywhere. This is too good an opportunity to pass up. And so we very quickly, I mean, in a matter of about a week or so, mobilized collaborators across the eruption zone from New England out into Minnesota.
One of the big questions for researchers has been why so many of these big fluffy raptors have flown south from the Arctic this year. Henry Tepper is president of Mass Audubon. They've long been involved in owl research, in part because so many snowy owls spend time at the Boston airport. They've seen 85 snowy owls so far this winter.
Some original thinking, which was just kind of logical, was that these birds were showing up in the wintertime because they were hungry, because their food supply in the tundra and the Arctic and the boreal areas was somehow limited. That actually turns out not to be true.
Researchers say most of the owls they've captured are well-fed and healthy. Tepper and others attribute this to a population boom in hamster-like rodents known as lemmings in the Arctic during the owls' breeding season last year.
And that resulted in a lot of food supply for snowy owls and therefore very high nesting productivity. So there were a lot of young birds hatched last season. And then what happens is when winter comes, you have a lot of young birds and they're chased off their feeding grounds by adult birds. And they have to range much more widely in search of food in the wintertime.
That's the best explanation researchers have so far about why the owls have flown thousands of miles south, showing up in backyards, along roadsides, and at airports. But it begs the question, why were there so many lemmings? Naturalist Paul Weidensahl says it's just part of their natural population cycle.
They boom and bust roughly every 4 years, and that's typical of a lot of small rodents up in northern areas. They're not really quite sure what causes the cycle.
But some researchers think there's more going on. Lemmings usually burrow in Arctic grasses hidden by snow. By one theory, warming temperatures and less snow have given them fewer places to hide and made them easier prey for snowy owls. But Weidensahl wouldn't connect the owl eruption with warming Arctic temperatures.
No, definitely not. I really don't see any link between this and climate change.
But some research out of Greenland shows the lemming population is collapsing in parts of the Arctic, and that could be affecting snowy owls. Other work has described how melting sea ice is making it more difficult for the owls to find ducks, a major source of food in the winter. Henry Tepper at Audubon understands why some scientists are leery of pegging the snowy owl eruption to climate change.
We have to be careful about speculation. We have to be careful about thinking that we know or saying that we know more about these birds than we really do. But we also know what is going on out there, and we also know that the movement of different species is changing and being disrupted.
One thing the researchers agree on is there's a lot to learn about these mysterious raptors, and this year's Southern Travels are providing the best chance yet to study them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
And recording from the scene in that story was provided by Mary Birdsong of the Presque Isle Audubon Society. She also shared photos of the owls from her friends in the Audubon Society, which you can find at AlleghenyFront.org. In case you're wondering what snowy owls sound like, I was. Here's an audio recording from Cornell University's Macaulay Library. It was submitted from Canada in 2008. The woman who recorded it noted that what was happening was that a female was at the nest with hatchlings when the male brought a dead lemming and passed it to the female, who fed the young. We just heard about snowy owls and some of the debate about what's causing them to come to Pennsylvania in these big numbers, whether climate change is a factor. Those kinds of events are what we'll be examining as we embark on the Allegheny Front's Climate Chronicles, a series of reports and interviews all through this year about how climate change can impact us locally and what we as individuals, as a city, as a state, and region may be able to do locally to stem it. Here to talk more about this series is the Allegheny Front's executive producer, Kathy Naur. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jennifer.
So last year we covered water issues in depth and how the fracking boom will probably turn into the petrochemical boom. Would you like to talk about why we'll have this focus on climate change?
Sure, Jennifer. Climate change is one of those really complex topics that's full of doom and gloom and fraught with politics that a lot of people are just tuning in out. They don't want to know about it. They don't want to know about the solutions. And people also hear about climate change impacting places like the Arctic or island nations or along the coastal areas. But we want to bring climate change here to your doorstep of Pennsylvania. How will it impact us? We'll see more extreme weather, how that's going to impact lower-income people, elderly, people with chronic illnesses. We'll look at how wildlife in Pennsylvania may survive in a changing climate. Scientists are researching that now and trying to figure out how to save some species or habitats. So we'll be looking at how climate change is impacting us here in Pennsylvania, because that's really, I think, how people are going to connect to this issue. And the Pittsburgh Foundation is funding this project. They're really interested in these issues of environment and social equity, so that fits right into all of the issues of climate change.
And so people are always saying, what can we do? We think we here at the Allegheny Front have an important role of spreading the word.
That's right. So we're really trying to educate people on this topic through talking with experts and featuring stories of people doing things to really stem climate change. So we really see ourselves as educating the public, and we'll be focusing this all year, so it'll be something that will unfold throughout 2014. We'll also have a public event on the issue where we will invite people to connect with us on this issue, bring in experts to talk as well. So in the meantime, you can always email us at info@AlleghenyFront.org with any of your climate questions or concerns. We'll be heavily engaged on Twitter with this issue at Allegheny Front, and our hashtag is AFClimate. We're on Facebook as well. So we're going to try to engage people in this issue as much as we can.
Right now, looking out the window, there's still some snow out there, and we're focused on that a lot. Later on today's show, I'll check in with a Penn State oceanographer who's pretty bummed out that we'll be seeing a lot less snow cover. How about a preview of the next few weeks' coverage?
Well, of course, renewable energy is the key to this climate change question. Our energy and shale reporter, Reed Fraser, will begin a series of his reports looking into renewable energy. We'll be looking at wind energy in Pennsylvania. And as you mentioned, snow is still a focus here in Western Pennsylvania. Kara Holsapple was looking at a citizen science project that's really trying to engage backyard ice rink owners and trying to get them to report back on the conditions of their rink, and really help scientists looking at weather and climate patterns and educating people at the same time.
You know, Kathy, I think one of the things that's been interesting to me and others and you, I know, as we start to investigate these pieces is that happily this isn't all doom and gloom. But, you know, they say in terms of how bad it's going to get, it's really up to us and the actions we take. And I think we should end with a quote. Julie Grant's been really moved after talking to Penn State forestry professor James Finley. So let's hear from him.
My woods in my backyard contribute to a solution. My decision to drive a hybrid car links to that solution. My decision to put solar panels on my house links to that decision. My decision to put CFLs in my house, or LED lights rather than incandescent light bulbs, is part of the decision. Don't just say, I don't believe in it. Think about how you can be part of the solution.
That is a nice quote. I mean, it gives people hope that some of their decisions may make a difference. So that's a good quote from James Finley.
I've been speaking with Kathy Naur, executive producer of this program, The Allegheny Front. You can find all of our stories in this series at alleghenyfront.org/climatechronicles. And as we begin our Climate Chronicles series, a new poll finds that about 55% of Pennsylvanians believe that tax dollars should be redirected to help reduce global warming or climate change. About the same number feel they can make a difference to slow global warming. This comes from a poll conducted by Robert Morris University's Polling Institute that queried 1,000 people nationally and about half that number in Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Justin Brown has more.
Nationally, some 70% of people believe global warming is, quote, very or somewhat real. The study differentiated between the terms climate change and global warming. Tony Kurzman teaches mechanical engineering and energy and sustainability at Robert Morris. He proposed the study topic and analyzed the results.
The fact that we have only 70% of the national population believes global warming is real or somewhat real is actually a very low number, I would say. The fact of the matter is global warming it should be 100% at this point. And maybe that goes to show that we need to educate our public a little bit more.
Nationally, the study showed perhaps surprising results when it came to party lines. 86% of Democrats agree that global warming exists, and more than half of Republicans surveyed say the same. One big difference in the survey findings was that Republicans are more confident than Democrats that they can help curb global warming or climate change. Kurzman says this might mean Republicans are more inclined to promote individual efforts instead of relying on raising taxes or other governmental policies to deal with climate change. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Justin Brown.
If snow isn't still on the ground where you live, it's certainly a fresh memory. As we begin the Allegheny Front's Climate Chronicles series on how our region will be affected and can contribute to climate change, I'm talking with Penn State oceanographer Ray Najar. He says snow's part of our region's character, a part that will be largely missed in a warming world. Ray's contributed to Pennsylvania's climate impacts assessment and to federal climate change reports for the Mid-Atlantic region. He joins me from WPSU studio in State College. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Why don't we jump right into the snow picture? What will Pennsylvania look like?
Under these future emission scenarios over the next 30 years and then the following 30 years, pretty much the state is almost completely devoid of snow. You know, it's still going to snow. It'll just be dramatically reduced. And in fact, we may have more, and it seems likely that we'll have more precipitation during the winter. More total precipitation, so that is rain plus snow, but the fraction of that will be snow will dramatically decline because of the higher temperatures.
And I guess what's your personal reaction as you think of the models and what that means for us?
You know, it's totally different. I've been living in Pennsylvania for the last 20 years. I grew up in the Northeast. And the climate really is a central defining character of a region, right? When you travel somewhere, it's sort of the first thing you look at. Well, what's the climate like? What kind of weather can I expect? And it's often one of the first things people talk about when they talk about where they live. So to imagine Pennsylvania with, you know, summers like northern Alabama summers and winters that are, you know, pretty much, you know, devoid of snow. And, you know, some people might like that, you know, but I feel like it's upsetting the balance.
Could you talk about your faith in the kind of models that have been developed to date?
Yeah, certainly they're not perfect. And as a statistician famously said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. Climate models are very useful. They're really our only window into the future. And they are remarkably good at simulating the large-scale patterns of the Earth's climate. Many countries have their own climate models. And particularly when you look at them in the aggregate, what we call the consensus forecast, a kind of average of all the models, typically does the best. And that's what I found for the state of Pennsylvania, that the average of the models does surprisingly well at simulating a number of features of Pennsylvania's climate.
So do I understand correctly that we're already locked into some of the changes you've described?
Well, carbon dioxide is a very interesting gas. It has a long lifetime in the atmosphere. So if you know, we're adding carbon dioxide, CO2, to the atmosphere, it's sort of slowly absorbed. If we were to stop emitting it, its concentration would begin to decrease, but very slowly over many decades or 100 years. So, and it would continue to have that warming influence. This is quite different from other pollutants like sulfur dioxides and nitrogen oxides, which when you reduce their emissions, they're very quickly removed from the atmosphere. Furthermore, the warming that the carbon dioxide causes, much of it is stored in the ocean. The warming that we're currently experiencing is really not due to the emissions that we're emitting now or we've emitted in the past year or so. Rather, it's an accumulation of emissions that's occurred over many many decades. So what this means is that as we go into the near future, the next 30 years or so, the specific emissions trajectory that we go on over the next decade or two probably won't have a big effect on short-term warming. However, where it really does matter is when you get out towards the middle and the end of the century. So the basically what we're emitting now is going to have a longer-term impact, and by then, it really makes a difference.
As you know, Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection Secretary Chris Abruzzo says he sees no need to change any of Pennsylvania's policies to deal with what he views as a very small amount and impacts from climate change. What do you think about that?
I think it's a bad idea. I think we need to dramatically reduce our emissions, and I think we can do it. Renewable energy technologies are here, and the cost associated with them compared to the economic costs and the sort of ethical implications of a warming planet are modest. So we should, in other words, what I'm saying is that reducing emissions makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of, in terms of economics, it makes a lot of sense to reduce emissions. And in terms of just doing what's right, the golden rule, we should be reducing emissions because the most vulnerable are going to be the ones that are going to suffer from from global warming and associated climate change. So I think this is a solvable problem. And, a lot of what we seem to hear is gloom and doom, and this, we're stuck with something that we can't get out of. We're totally backed into a corner, and I think we often forget that we have solved really big problems in the past, and the next generation of young scientists and policymakers, I have faith in them. I observe them in the classroom and interact with them on research projects.
Well, thank you so much.
That was my pleasure, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
That was Ray Najjar. He's an oceanographer with Penn State University, and he contributed to Pennsylvania's latest climate impacts assessment. You can find more on that and other reports that Najjar contributed to at AlleghenyFront.org. And this is part of our Climate Chronicle series on the impacts of climate change in our area. As the Allegheny Front series Climate Chronicles continues next week, warming winters mean some city dwellers will have to quadruple their drive time for ski trips. That's because the lack of snow might dry up some ski resorts.
Later century, particularly under the warmer scenarios, now you're looking at a 50% loss in your ski season, so that's no longer sustainable at that level.
Listen for that story next week as Climate Chronicles continues on the Allegheny Front. The 24th annual International Water Tasting Competition took place recently in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. The Canadian town of Clearbrook in British Columbia walked away with the trophy for Best Municipal Tap Water. This year's panel of judges included West Virginia Public Broadcasting Executive Director Scott Finn. He lives in Charleston, where his family had to deal with the chemicals spill and water crisis earlier this year. This gave Finn a decidedly different viewpoint as he rated the water.
When I signed up to be a judge at the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting, I thought it would be just a bit of fun. Then came the water crisis, a massive spill of the coal cleaning chemical MCHM into our water supply. My 7-year-old son, Max, came down with the stomach flu right in the middle of all this. We couldn't use the tap water, not to wash our hands or even our clothes. I'll spare you the details, but it was rough. So you can understand how this bill changed my outlook toward a water tasting competition. I learned to trust my sense of smell in more ways than one. A panel of mostly novices like me were to judge dozens of samples of tap water and bottled water, both sparkling and non-carbonated. We were trained by water master Arthur von Weisenberger, whose name so perfectly matches his job, I'm skeptical that his name is real. Good water, von Weisenberger told us, should have no odor. It may have a taste based on the minerals, but it should not smell. Yeah, the smell. That black licorice smell. After the spill, it wasn't just coming from the water. It permeated the air of the entire Kanawha Valley. It was astringent. It hurt to breathe it too deeply. After state officials finally stopped the MCHM, after they told us to flush our pipes, you could still smell it in the water for weeks. I would engage in a nervous ritual, run the tap, lean in a little, and there it would be. So at the water tasting, when von Weisenberger told us to sniff the water 3 times to judge its odor, I knew exactly what to do. I soon realized that my sense of smell was one of the best indicators of whether I'd like the taste. I've never spent much time thinking about smells, but my son does. Max has autism, and he has trouble understanding the world through speech, so Max relies on his other senses, including smell. He has this habit of bringing all food and liquids to his nose and smelling it before deciding whether he'll eat or drink it. He acts like we're trying to poison him. But after the water crisis, I get it. Smell is what you depend upon when you don't trust anything else. It's our most primal sense. The other day at a grocery store in Charleston, they were selling a t-shirt with a picture of a man in a gas mask, emblazoned with the phrase, "Trust no one." Trust no one. That's the lasting damage of the spill in my community. We were failed by all of our institutions, the government, private industry, the water company. After the water tasting, I learned that Clearbrook, British Columbia, has the best tasting tap water in the world. In Santa Ana, California, it's tops in the U.S. And then I looked at the list of winners from the past, and there it was. Charleston, West Virginia, in the top 5 for best tasting tap water in 2 different years. Having the best water in the world is a proxy for so many other things: clean air, clean living, and a well-functioning, competent government. Maybe by following our sense of smell, my beautiful little city in the valley can find its way forward again.
That was West Virginia Public Broadcasting Executive Director Scott Finn talking about his experience as the judge of a water contest just months after he experienced the water crisis in Charleston, West Virginia. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kara Holsapple is the production and digital editor. Kathy Nauer is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Please tune in for all of our Climate Chronicles reporting and follow along on the web at alleghenyfront.org/climatechronicles. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments. Our coverage of the Marcellus Shale is supported by the Roy A. Hunt Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the George and Miriam Martin Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports Climate Chronicles, our series on climate change.